Now, these are called innate releasing mechanisms. And this stimulus sets going a system of action which is built into the central nervous system. There are such in man as well. And this is what is meant by instinct. The complication of instinct. If you will read, for example, some of the life histories of parasites, you won't believe it. Read the life course of a hydrophobia parasite, and you won't think that a human being is worthy to be host to such a genius. But they know what to do, where to go, and how to set people mad. Now, in the human being, we have an instinct system, and it is pushing us. But we have also a culture system. Now, the peculiar thing about man that distinguishes him from all other animals is that he's born 12 years too soon. No mother would wish that it should not be so. But nevertheless, there are these 12 years of utter dependency that the child is committed to. It is during those 10 years or 12 that the child is turned into a human being. It learns to walk as its people walk. It learns to speak, to think, to cogitate in the vocabulary of that local language. It learns to respond with enthusiasm to certain signals and with fear to others, which are not natural but are socially oriented and socially functioning signals. A mythology is the context of nature and culture signals in such a close amalgam that you can hardly distinguish them from each other. And they work on the psyche as naturally and spontaneously as the stimuli of nature on an animal. A functioning mythological symbol is an energy-evoking and directing sign. It does not have to pass through the brain and be interpreted there. It works like that. The brain, however, may interfere and short-circuit it. And when that happens, the signals are not functioning. Or one may become conditioned to a system of signals which are present only in a very small portion of the environment. For instance, people who are brought up in quite special sects who do not participate in the culture forms of the rest of the environment, they can never learn to participate in the culture except in its small dimension, the small dimension of their local family, and so forth. That person is disoriented in the larger world altogether. There's a very important problem families face: to know that the signals that they are imprinting on their children are signals that are not going to alienate them from the world in which those children are going to live. They have to be in accord with at least the progressive, decent aspects of the world into which they're coming. So we have this terrible problem in the human system of signals delivering messages to our psyche which may or may not relate us propitiously to the environment. And when the signals do not relate us to the environment, we find ourselves in what in the mythological world is called a wasteland situation. The world does not talk to us, we do not talk to it. When that happens, the individual is cut off and thrown back on himself, and it's then that this crisis occurs, which may be called the psychotic break-off. Let me, before going into this history of the break-off, the crisis, and the return, just say another word or two about the functions served by a functioning mythology. They are fourfold. There are four main functions that a traditional, operative, a healthy mythological system serves. The first is what might be called the mystical function, to awaken and maintain in the individual a sense of awe and gratitude for the mystery dimension of the universe, and not to be afraid of it, but to recognize that it is his own mystery dimension as well. That's what that shaman meant when he said, do not be afraid of the universe. It is terrible. It is monstrous. It is the kind of thing that makes existentialist Frenchmen say it is absurd. The second function of a mythology is to present an image of the universe, an image of the universe which works in terms of the knowledge and science and fields of achievement and action of the people of that time. And through that cosmological image, there comes the dimension of mystery as well. Now, when a mythology like that of most of our inherited religions is based on a cosmology, as I pointed out last week, of 4,000 years out of date, there is a discontinuity there, and we are being introduced to a world that is not our world at all. This kind of inheritance is, you might say, a guide to schizophrenia. The third function of a mythology is to validate, support, and inculcate the norms of a given specific moral order, that of the society in which the individual is living. And the fourth function is to carry an individual through the stages of his development. Now, the first stage is, of course, that of the child in utter dependence on his family for 12 years. On the earlier biological levels, there is a condition comparable to this, the condition of the marsupial. You know, kangaroos and wallabies and opossums. These are not placental animals. There's no placenta, so that the little fetus cannot remain in the womb after the yolk of the egg has been consumed. And so it must be born before it's at all mature. And after 18 days, the little kangaroo is born, and spontaneously, through instinct, it crawls up to its mother's pouch, attaches itself to a nipple there, which swells in its mouth so it can't get loose, and there it is in a second womb, a womb with a view. Now, I think it's important to realize that one of the first functions of mythology is to serve as a womb with a view. And it doesn't matter whether it makes rational sense or not. What matters is, does it keep the little developing psyche cozy? Does it furnish it spiritual, emotional, feeling nourishment? Does it help it to grow up to be a kangaroo in our society and not in that of some other part of the universe or time of human history? The mythology has to bring this little thing to maturity, and then the aim is for the little thing to step out, to leave the myth, to be, as they say, twice born, to leave the myth behind.